Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Keeping in mind the fog of war, we are still getting some extraordinary stories out of Ukraine, including this rather extraordinary piece in the New York Times that says that U.S. estimates, conservative U.S. estimates, put the number of Russian soldiers killed in action in less than 3 weeks at more than 7,000. Now, if that is true, I'm underlining that, that is absolutely staggering. And the Times puts this in some context. In the 36 days of fighting on Iwo Jima during World War II, nearly 7,000 Marines were killed. Now, 20 days after Putin invaded Ukraine, his military has already lost more soldiers, according to American intelligence estimates. The conservative side of the estimate, at more than 7,000 Russian troop deaths, is greater than the number of American troops killed over 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. So let's just sort out where we are at on all of this with one of my go-to sources on social media. And I'm really pleased to have him on the podcast today, Michael Weiss, who's the news director at the global affairs magazine New Lines. He is also editor at large at the Daily Beast, director of special investigations at the Free Russia Foundation, and is the co-author of ISIS Inside the Army of Terror. And his forthcoming book is about the GRU, Russia's military intelligence agency. So, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Happy to be with you.
So before we get into this, can I just tell you about a surreal experience I had last night?
Well, it depends if it's last night. But yeah, go ahead. We'll take it one step at a time, Charles.
Oh, okay. I started watching Servant of the People on Netflix, which, of course, is the Vladimir Zelensky comedy about this guy unexpectedly becoming president of Ukraine. And of course, this was the show that helped propel him into being the actual president of Ukraine. And so to watch him playing the president of Ukraine in this comedy, this Ukrainian comedy, the same day that he's addressing Congress, is just, the juxtaposition is really remarkable. I mean, it is one of the greatest plot twists ever. I mean, it feels like just circles within circles of all of this, but it's worth watching if for no other reason to get some sense of what Kyiv looked like, what Ukraine was, what the political culture in that country was. But it is remarkable. And so just FYI, it's streaming on Netflix. But Michael, I mean, in terms of the, you know, unexpected plot developments in world history, the rise of President Zelensky is certainly one of them, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, as you pointed out, you know, first of all, that show is brilliant in its own right. I mean, he's kind of the Armando Iannucci of Ukraine. And he came to power in 2019 with more than 73% of the vote. So it was a landslide win, all on the basis of, you know, his sort of satirical wit and his puncturing the hypocrisy and cynicism and just rampant corruption of the Ukrainian establishment. But I will say, I was in Kyiv 5 weeks ago now, so it was the end of January, beginning of February, and Zelensky's stock was at Enron levels. He was polling below 30% in the 20s. Everybody was kind of disenchanted with him. They didn't think he had delivered on many of the promised reforms. There was, you know, he was going after his predecessor, Petro Poroshenko, trying to get him legally indicted for treason and all these things that, in a way, made him very much the kind of figures that he himself had parodied so ably in that show, right? People felt that he lost his luster and become just another kind of establishment politician. So war occurs. Ukraine is invaded by Russia. And I mean, talk about rising to the moment. Nobody, myself included, just based on my own reporting, thought that he had this in him. I mean, perhaps some people knew him better and always knew he was going to kind of become this heroic figure, but I'm certainly taken aback by it. And you can imagine, I think, how people who had never heard of him before must feel or must see him now as this kind of inspirational figure. I've been using the line, Charlie Chaplin into Winston Churchill transformation. But even that doesn't do much justice. I mean, you know, yes, it's true, Churchill kind of famously paraded on rooftops during the Blitz, but, you know, London was never encircled on the ground. Actually, I shouldn't even say encircled because Kyiv is not encircled. And that's something I want to get into in the show about the way the media is reporting on the war. But you know what I mean? I mean, Zelensky has survived now more than three assassination plots, according to his security establishment. He's still there and he's still in complete command and control of his armed forces, and they're doing well. That's the other kind of miraculous thing about all this.
And I want to get to that in just a second, but I think your line about Charlie Chaplin into Winston Churchill is actually pretty good, because, you know, as I'm watching this, I'm thinking he plays this character as a pretty schleppy guy. He's a little guy, and, you know, the shoulders are slumped, and he is the least likely sort of figure. He's not an imposing figure, at least in the early episode. I have not gotten to the, you know, later episodes of the show. But okay, so let's talk about what is happening there. And before we get into this, though, because I ask this on a regular basis on this podcast, the question: how do we know what we know? How do we know what is true? What we pay attention to? Because again, it's a cliche to say there's, you know, the fog of war, but we're also living in this age of massive propaganda and disinformation. So, how do you sort it out? Just tell me about how you are watching what's happening on the ground in Ukraine.
So, I mean, look, the Ukrainians put out these daily briefings. The Ministry of Defense has their figures. All of it focused on Russian losses. Russian losses in terms of materiel, so tanks, armored personnel, carriers, in some cases, very expensive air defense systems. And then they put out this figure that's basically personnel losses, I think is how they describe it. And from the very beginning of the war, I've been trying to drill down what do they exactly mean by that? Are they talking about killed in action, fatalities, or are they using this as a grab bag term for casualties, which would include killed in action, wounded in action, deserters, and POWs. And the best that I can determine, and this is based on sources within the Ukrainian military intelligence service, they are indeed conflating fatalities with casualties. Mm-hmm. Now, for their purposes, they want to emphasize the higher figure. So when they say we've got, you know, we've taken out 14,000 Russian soldiers, that's good for morale on the Ukrainian side. But you know, it's really, is that, you know, can you be a little more specific? So they're being non-specific for a reason. So that's one thing. When you say, how do we know? I mean, look, there's one website, I think it's manned by three or four people. And one of them I know, he's a Czech open source intelligence analyst. It's called Oryx. Oryx is really good because what Oryx does is they take every video, every image that's uploaded. And by the way, you know, sometimes they call BS on Ukrainian claims. Right. Ukraine will say that they shot down two aircraft. Show me the wreckage, you know, like where's the evidence for this? But Oryx does open source verification. And the numbers that Oryx has come up with for this are staggering. In fact, I mean, if I quote from what I last saw, it will be out of date because that's how quickly and how frequently Oryx is updating its figure. But let me just call up now, if you don't mind. I'm going to do a little research whilst I'm talking to you. They have this dynamic blog, Attack on Europe, Documenting Equipment Losses During the 2022 Russian Invasion of Ukraine. And let me just give you the top line figure. Russia, 1,421 pieces of equipment, of which 630 were destroyed, 21 were damaged, 213 were abandoned, and 557 were captured. These figures, then this is just kit. We're not even talking about personnel or soldiers. These figures are remarkable. They are staggering, especially when you factor in what the Ukrainians have managed to take away from the Russians on the battlefield, but also factor in all of the stuff that's been, quote, abandoned. What this suggests is the Russians, the crew members of the tanks, the guys driving, you know, the self-propelled artillery systems, whatever, they just ran off into the woods, into the countryside. They don't want to fight. So that tells me that actually what the manpower shortages that Russia is sustaining are quite high, because it's not just people who are getting injured through, you know, combat or having bombs dropped on them, whether they're Bayraktar Turkish drones or indeed, you know, the Ukrainian Air Force is still largely intact 3 weeks in. Nobody thought that was going to happen either. A lot of Russian soldiers simply don't want to fight. They were misled, they claim. They did not know they were even going to war. A lot of them maintain, those who had been captured by the Ukrainians, and, you know, take this with a pinch of salt because we don't know what kind of duress they've been right. under. But a lot of them have maintained with seeming authenticity, if you listen to these videos, that they were told they were just going on training exercises. And indeed, I mean, a lot of the reporting that's been done thus far suggests only a very tight-knit group of people at the very high echelons of the Russian government and military and security establishments knew Putin was going to do this. Everyone else was kind of under the illusion that, well, these are just exercises. There's no there. In fact, I met yesterday with a diplomat here in New York at the UN who told me that on Army Day, which is the date of the invasion, February, whatever it was, 20-something, the Russian mission to the United Nations, which is very famously pro-Putin nationalistic, ideological. I mean, these are the guys that traffic in all the crazy conspiracy theories about Syrian chemical weapons use. Now they're lying about false flag attacks, including a bombardment of a theater in Mariupol yeah. where children and women were domiciled or taking shelter, I should say. This diplomat told me there was a reception on Army Day. And the minute the word came down that Russian bombs had started falling on Ukraine, I mean, they were half in the bag because, you know, they're Russian diplomats. They had to scramble back to the UN Security Council. They were completely ill-prepared. They had no idea this was going to happen. So Putin's own foreign ministry, his own diplomatic corps, including at the UN, which has historically been a very sensitive terrain for Russia, didn't seem to know that this thing was in the offing. Now, of course, US intelligence was quite good, almost down to the exact date. But the certainty of the inevitability of this war was something that was propounded and, frankly, ventilated through American media for, we all remember, weeks leading up to it, right? Now, the question is, how did the Americans know this? Was it just based on signals intercepts? My working hypothesis, and I have seen some evidence to suggest that this is true, is that actually Western intelligence services have got moles inside Russia at very high levels. At the very least, the Russians are leaking things. Possibly and probably, I should say, because they don't want this war. They think that Putin is engaged in a massive, catastrophic folly.
Well, that's got to mess with Vladimir Putin's head, as we were discussing on the podcast yeah. yesterday. So you believe these numbers from Oryx? I mean, I just want to establish that.
He's got receipts, okay. as we say. I mean, he shows you the evidence. Literally, when you go to this website, for every single piece of equipment he labels destroyed or damaged or captured or abandoned, you click on a link and it'll take you to the image or the video showing it. And he's very good at geolocating where these things are. You know, I mean, remember, we live in not just an age of propaganda disinformation born digitally and, you know, circulating throughout the world at all 24/7, but also an age of where, you know, you take a photograph in Timbuktu and, you know, these online sleuths and geeks are able to figure out the exact spot and the exact time of day it was taken based on, you know, the shadows on the ground. So indicating where the sun was in the sky, this kind of thing. I mean, people who are a lot smarter and better at this than I am, I am relying on them. And look, what's interesting and what I can tell you is the people doing this stuff the best and the sources that I am heavily dependent on, I got to know their work during the Syrian civil war. Right? They really kind of cut their teeth tracking, not, even before the Russian intervention in 2015, just, you know, Syrian rebels fighting the regime, where they were fighting, what kinds of equipment and weaponry they were using, what it was suggestive of in terms of Western and particularly American covert arms supplies going to them. And they don't, I mean, some of them do have a dog in the fight. They're very supportive of Ukraine. They're very fond of the Turkish drone system, the Bayraktar TB2, but they're honest. And like I said earlier, when Ukraine is telling Porky's, they are the first to point that out. You know, Ukraine might recycle a video from late February and claim that it happened yesterday. So these guys will call BS on that too. So look, I mean, yeah. It's as good as of a portal into what is happening on the ground as we can get without being on the ground. And actually, in a way, it's better because if you're on the ground, you know, let's say I'm in Kharkiv. I don't really know what's going on in Kyiv. I don't know what's going on in Mariupol. I don't know what's going on in Kherson. So being remote does give you that sort of 30,000 altitude view of the situation. And I can tell you, look, a lot of journalists are ringing up or direct messaging this guy. Again, it's a collective. Well, let's just call him Oryx. How do you know what you know? How are you doing this? And he's just at a point where, how are you not doing this? You know, all of this information is readily available. You just have to know where to kind of hoover it up on Telegram, on Facebook, on Twitter, et cetera. So that's kind of my go-to
network. This is very helpful. Yeah.
Does that mean that we have total comprehensive clarity? Of course not. Of course not. But to be honest with you, I mean, does the Pentagon, does the Defense Intelligence Agency or the CIA have that? I don't think they do. And, you know, what I've noticed is the Europeans, I mean, maybe you wanted to hold this question for a little bit later, but European intelligence and defense analysts, particularly those who come from former Warsaw Pact nations or indeed from the former Soviet Union, and by those I'm referring explicitly to the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, they have spent the last 30 plus years with one preternatural and indeed existential obsession in terms of national security, Russia. These countries, the ones in NATO, they helped fight in Afghanistan after 9/11. You know, they've shed their own blood on behalf of American national security interests, which I guess international security interests as well. But their overriding obsession, fixation is Russia, Russian intelligence services, Russian military posture. All of these reforms that, you know, this bright, shiny new army that Putin has been professing to have and was promised to him by his defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, and the chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov, they were always of the mind that there's less there than meets the eye. Because if you know anything about Russia, and even if you don't know anything about Russia, even if you just watch Alexei Navalny's viral videos about graft and corruption and thieving politicians, thieving foreign ministers, thieving, you know, patriarchs of the Orthodox Church who are wearing watches that, you know, people on lowly salaries, such as those that they claim to have on paper, simply cannot afford. You know that corruption is really the cancer that has rotted out all of Russian society, all of Russian state institutions. And so, you know, with a little bit of hindsight now, 3 weeks into this thing, you know, those of us who sat around predicting a blitzkrieg operation, decapitation of the government in Kyiv, you know, using VDV paratroopers and GRU Spetsnaz forces and all this stuff, it kind of beggars belief that we didn't have the political imagination to realize that there is no way that the Russian military was somehow going to be immune to that cancer of corruption. And I'm hearing things now like very credible sourcing coming out of Russia that internal audits are underway and they're finding that things they were promised that were meant to have been manufactured and paid for out of the state budget never got made because people were just expropriating the funds for their own personal gain. Not a surprise.
Yeah. So let's talk about the actual state of play, because I have to admit that I don't want to engage in wish casting. So there are reports that come out and I think I want to believe those reports, but I am skeptical of the reports. So this morning, we are hearing reports of actual counteroffensive by the Ukraine. We're getting these numbers of these horrific casualty numbers, which would suggest that things are going much worse for the Russians than maybe we had even expected, even after 21 days. And the things are going better for the Ukrainians. I want to just ask you about one specific thing. You've been talking, as you just mentioned, you've been talking to some of these European intelligence agencies. And I was struck by what you said the other day, that you checked in with an Estonian expert on the Russian military defense establishment. And basically, he told you the idea that Kyiv is encircled is just nonsense. The Estonian said they're very far from encircling it. Now, again, you know, got somebody like me, I'm looking at the maps that I'm seeing, you know, in the American media and the Western media, and it certainly looks like they are close to encircling it, but he says no. So talk to me about that.
So those maps, I have a big problem with those maps. They use a lot of red shading and terms thrown around like Russian-controlled territory. The Russians aren't controlling anything in those areas, and those kind of red-tinted gradients. There's a good map maker by the name of Nathan Russer. I believe he actually did a lot of work using satellite footage to determine the precise location of where the Chinese government was interning Uyghurs and Kazakh Muslims in Xinjiang. So he's got a lot of really good insight into kind of figuring out terrain from, again, satellite footage. He puts together these maps which show kind of skeletal lines of red. It's a lot less menacing than the stuff that the BBC and other outlets are putting out. And what he's showing with those skeletal lines of red is where Russian troops are contesting areas where they're fighting with the Ukrainians. But this idea of control, I mean, the one city that they've got under their nominal control is Kherson. And the videos and the images coming out of the city are, I'm not kidding, like crowds of people, including like babushkas, little old ladies, going up to guys with guns and telling them to F off back to Russia. We all know about the Ukrainian tractor, the symbol of this war, because they're literally stealing tens of millions of dollars in Russian equipment, you know, towing it with their little John Deere brigade. I've seen images of Ukrainian tractors flying the Ukrainian flag through the streets of Kherson. So control is a pregnant and complicated term. But in terms of the encirclement of Kyiv, look, you don't have to listen to my sources, although I suggest you do, because a lot of what Carl, as we call him, said has been borne out in the last 3 days, including this failure of an amphibious landing at Odessa, which the Ukrainians are now saying is, you know, those ships that are in the Black Sea are really there for psychological pressure. But anyway, you don't have to believe what my guys tell you. Ask yourself the following. How was it that a day ago, I'm losing track of time because I haven't been sleeping very much, a day ago or more, three prime ministers from EU NATO countries managed to travel to Kyiv and meet with President Zelensky.
And they traveled by train.
They didn't teleport there. Right. They didn't fly there. They took the train. If Kyiv is encircled, how did they get there? Did the Russians let them through their checkpoints? I mean, just common sense, you know? And in terms of, like, I'm hearing a lot, and people, you know, let's not be too optimistic. Let's not wish cast. I'm not wish casting. I take it day to day. Tomorrow, we could wake up and discover Putin has unleashed a chemical weapon in Kharkiv or over the skies of Kyiv. We could find that he dropped a tactical nuke in central Ukraine. I mean, there are a lot of things that could really sort of turn the tides of this thing in Russia's favor, which I worry about all the time, and we all should. But this is not a question of wish casting. This is a question of just sober analysis and just looking at the reality of the situation. And where reporters have gone in and really reconstructed some of the battles, I would commend to your audiences a great report done by Yaroslav, who's a correspondent at the Wall Street Journal, who showed...
I stayed up late reading that piece. That is just riveting, yeah.
Forgive me, but I forget exactly where it was, but it was a Ukrainian counteroffensive, and they just mopped the floor with the Russians.
Yeah,
I think they destroyed upwards of 66% of the tanks the Russians had. There's a figure about 150 fatalities floating around in that report, but it's very granular detail. And again, this is journalism.
Russian survivors of the battle left behind nearly 30 of their 43 vehicles, tanks, armored personnel carriers, multiple rocket launchers, trucks, as a downed Mi-24 attack helicopter. So
there you go.
I mean, this was a rout.
And Yaroslav is in country. He's not sitting. I mean, look, you know, I am relying on people who were there. I have reporters in Kyiv who file dispatches for me. I have reporters in Odessa. I have one who's gone to Mykolaiv. So I'm listening to what journalists are saying. I'm taking that and trying to synthesize that with what the open source guys that I mentioned earlier are saying. And the appraisal, the picture that is painted for myself is that, yes, Russia is doing quite poorly. And now I see, frankly, the US and the UK defense establishments coming out a little more forward-footed and saying things like, we estimate conservatively. I mean, you read this at the opening of the show, 7,000 Russian dead. That's more than the Soviets lost 9 years in Afghanistan. Okay, and that's the conservative figure. That's a figure that, frankly, I was given by an Estonian intelligence officer several days ago. And that figure, when he gave it to me, it was already 3 days out of date. So I don't think it's Pollyannish or, you know, kind of overly emotional or wish-casting, whatever term you want to use, to just look at these figures and look at the sourcing for them and just come to a determination. Russia is certainly not winning the war. Now, whether Ukraine is winning it, I mean, at the beginning, the kind of standard line from those who study counterinsurgency and these kinds of, you know, sort of occupation style military campaigns said to win it, Ukraine just doesn't have to lose it. Well, I think I can say with pretty good confidence, they're not losing it yet.
So what do you make of these reports about the counterattack that, in fact, Ukrainian troops are driving the Russians back? Because we had been, you know, some reports had suggested that there was a lull in which the Russians were essentially gathering their strength for the next big push, or that they were reloading.
And yet with each date that goes by, it certainly looks like more of a quagmire than a reset. What do you think?
Right. And there's a reason that they're killing more civilians than they are Ukrainian soldiers, yeah. because, I mean, this is kind of the standard way of Russian warfare when it doesn't go their way. They resort to sieges. So, you know, you pound a city to dust with artillery, with missiles, with standoff weaponry from your air force. I mean, we saw it in Aleppo. Certainly, they use these kinds of tactics in Grozny and Chechnya in the 90s and early in the 2000s, I should say. And it seems like they're trying to do this to Mariupol now. But that, again, you know, this is a different set of conditions, because in order to have a strategic victory, what does Putin need? Well, originally it was regime change in Kyiv. He's a lot further away from that goal than he was a month ago, simply by dint of the fact that Zelensky and his cabinet are still there and they're still in command and control. Now there's sort of this idea that, well, maybe Russia will just go for the southeastern littoral, the land bridge, as it's known, connecting the People's Republics of Donetsk and Lugansk to Crimea, which it certainly seems like if they have a shot at anything, that's the best shot that they've got at the moment. But you have to understand, too, from military experts that I've talked to, including some active service American Air Force pilots and Army guys who really made a study of the last 20 years at, you know, counterinsurgency, but also just kind of conventional warfare tactics. The Ukrainians are doing well because they're resorting to mobile defense. So in other words, they're allowing Russia to kind of move in to places. They're giving up terrain so that basically then they send in their special forces. They send in some cases territorial defense guys who are well-trained to go behind enemy lines and just sabotage the Russians. Basically sandbag them, you know, take out their fuel supplies, interdict their supply lines, kill loads of soldiers, capture their kit, and then go back. And wait for the Russians to kind of be drawn out yet again. So the counteroffensive, I was speaking to a U.S. Army colonel, in fact, a week and a half ago, who was noticing what the Ukrainians were doing, and he's saying they're playing it very smart. But he said they're going to have to go on counteroffensives eventually in order to push the Russians back. And that, it seems, indeed is what it seems like they're doing now. I mean, there's been this massive push at Mykolaiv that the Ukrainians are engaged in, and it's the reason why. For, I believe, the last 3 days, Kyiv has been under curfew. So whilst the Ukrainians are going on counteroffensive in Mykolaiv, they're telling everyone in Kyiv, hunker down, and because what the Russians will do as they're losing ground that they had acquired is they'll just mercilessly bombard apartment blocks and residential areas.
Let's talk about what happened yesterday in Mariupol, where the theater where about 1,000 people had been taking refuge was bombed, and they had written the word kids in Russian, you know, right on kids, on the roof, and yet they bombed it anyway. So again, this is what a war crime looks like.
It is indeed, and you know, the good news, if you can call it that, is that a lot of most of the people that had hunkered down in the theater were in a bomb shelter in the basement, and so far I'm seeing reports that quite a number of them survived that attack. And as you say, a lot of them were women and children. Look, one of the problems, one of the things we learned from Syria is the UN, in its infinite naivete, and I guess its belief in good faith, would, when Russia started to intervene in 2015, they would give coordinates of hospitals, bakeries, civilian infrastructure to the Russians.
It's painful.
The Russians would use those coordinates and just bomb them. So, but they were given that stuff so that they knew what not to bomb. So if you think that this is in any way unprecedented or that the Russian way of war has any kind of nodding acquaintance with international law or norms or just basic human decency and morality, I got a lot of Syrian people I can introduce you to. So none of this surprises me in the least.
And none of this is new. My newsletter this morning, you know, I talked about, you know, Vladimir Putin being a war criminal, but he's been a war criminal for decades.
Correct.
And he has gotten away with it. He was a war criminal in Syria, war criminal in Chechnya. There's a long list of crimes. And yet, until about 5 minutes ago, we still gave him most favored nation status. He was given summits by presidents of both political parties. You know, Trump obviously, you know, gushed over him. But, you know, he knows what he's gotten away with. And he knows that we keep talking about war crimes, but is a war crime a war crime if the law is never enforced, if he is never held accountable? Because there's a long list of war crimes he's already committed.
And the first, I mean, if you want to go back to kind of Putin's origin story, I have yet to meet somebody who's come out of the American intelligence community, particularly the CIA, who is not absolutely certain that the Moscow apartment bombings in 1999 were orchestrated by the FSB to not only furnish a pretext for the Second Chechen War, but also to create a kind of rallying cry for Putin's political career. And, you know, Putin had just left the directorship of the FSB. He had been prime minister in 1999. Then he became Yeltsin's anointed successor as president. And the guy who was FSB director during those bombings was one Nikolai Patrushev, who is currently the secretary of Russia's Security Council and the second most powerful man in the country. Now, if you believe those allegations, and quite a lot of Russians still to this day will tell you they think their government blew up the apartment buildings. And I would recommend the work of David Satter, John Dunlop at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University. If you believe that, then Putin's entire career, his entire role as leader of Russia, is built atop a mass grave of Russian bodies, not Ukrainians, not Syrians. And most of the people who got blown up were ethnic Russians. They're not Chechens, or they don't come from they're not ethnic minorities from the regions. So let's drill down into this guy's role as a state terrorist and a war criminal. His career begins with acts of atrocity.
So let's talk about where we're at in the war right now. President Zelensky speaks to Congress yesterday, again asks for our help in closing the air, Ukraine's air. He's not going to get the no-fly zone. Doesn't look like he's going to get the jets. I don't know. But he's getting a lot of anti-aircraft equipment. The weapons that are on the way right now, that is a step up. Does this change the situation? Are we giving them the weapons they need right now to do what has to happen if they're going to survive?
So the latest reports I've seen suggest Slovakia will provide S-300 air defense systems, which the Ukrainians are well-versed in using. The Poles have got some Soviet-era surface-to-air missiles that can take out fighter jets and helicopters, of course. You know, Stingers, one of the things I had heard in Kyiv, actually from the Estonian ambassador who was there and who's really been sort of integral in helping to bolster Ukraine's defenses and security architecture, he told me, look, because of prevailing weather conditions around this time of year, but also because the Russians rely mostly on dumb munitions, dumb bombs instead of precision guided bombs, their planes, their jets are going to fly much lower than they ought to. And that's going to put them well within hitting range of things like Stinger missiles, which the United States has directly supplied the Ukrainians with. The Estonians have directly supplied them with. I think, look, air defense systems that the Ukrainians are already well trained on how to use, that stuff is good. There's a lot of contentiousness about the MiG-29s. Yeah. We don't need to get into the details there. When Zelensky gets up and says, close the sky, give me a no-fly zone, I think he knows in the back of his mind, and certainly there are people in the Ukrainian government who have told me, we know we're not going to get that. We know that NATO is not going to go to war for us. So what they're trying to do is create this moral imperative. Our people are dying because of Russia's air capability. Help us. Help us take out the jet. Help us stop the bombs. Help us stop the stuff that's coming in through the atmosphere, falling on schools, theaters, killing women and children. So what else is now being supplied, according to the United States and the latest readout from Tony Blinken? One thing that the Ukrainians had been asking for, at least as of last weekend, were Switchblade drones. Mm-hmm. Now, these are drones. The two varieties that they want are Switchblade 300s and 600s. The 300s have a Claymore munition that's very good at taking out things like Russian artillery. The 600s have got actually the same kind of munition that's built into the Javelin anti-tank system. So these things can take out tanks and armored vehicles. And they're about 5 pounds per drone. You can put one in the back of a rucksack. And I actually spent more time than I care to admit last night trying to figure out when the U.S. says we're sending 100 of these systems to Ukraine, what does systems mean? Well, apparently it means there's 10 of them per system. So it's actually 100 times 10. It's 1,000 drones that they're getting. Now, that's a good start. And these things are used by U.S. Special Forces. I think they can fly 4 miles, so that you can go behind enemy lines. You can take out, as I mentioned, artillery, tanks. You can take out air defense systems with them. It's good. It's good. Look, Ukrainians will tell you, at least you know, off the record or sometimes on, certainly before the war started, we will defend our country. Just help us. Give us the capability. Give us the weapons we need to do so. So if that's not going to be jets directly provided by Poland, the kit that they're receiving in ample quantities, keep it coming. You know, and the Estonians will tell you, as long as they do not have manpower shortages, which it does not seem that they do, we don't really know their losses because they're not advertising them, but we do know, and I can tell you, it's more than just what their on-paper order of battle for the conventional standing army was, which is around 260,000. They've got territorial defense. They've got National Guard. Their police force was militarized when I was there. They have the SBU, the intelligence service, which has military capability. And the other thing to keep in mind, this is very important, in the last 8 years, over 200,000 Ukrainians have fought against the Russians in the occupied territories of Donbass. Okay, so this is a country of 40 some odd million, and you know, minus or subtract the people who have fled, is about like 1% of the population. And now you're seeing, forget even the International Legion, you know, the Americans, the Brits, people as far afield as India wanting to join and fight. The Ukrainian diaspora is returning, particularly the men. 18 years and older to take up arms. So Ukraine is not going to run out of manpower. Russia will run out of manpower before Ukraine does.
That's amazing. That's remarkable. Okay, one question about the weapons, because this is way outside my wheelhouse, my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. My understanding, and correct me at every step of the way here, my understanding is the Stingers are general, and the Javelins are effective at low altitudes. These S-300s, are they a capable of taking out high altitude Russian jets?
Yes, I believe so. And certainly, you know, remember, why was Turkey kicked out of the F-35 program and why were they sanctioned? Yeah. Because they had received S-400s, which is the kind of newer, swishier model of the S-300 Russian air defense systems. So I think that the Ukrainians even have S-400s, or they did have at the start of the conflict. I'm not 100% sure of that. But yes, these are good systems that they know how to use that can take out Sukhois and MiGs. And again, high altitude is, you know, the Russians aren't flying high altitude because they can't really see what's on the ground that way. And, you know, I mean, that could change if fog or cloud cover lifts and all that. And look, I am not a military expert. I have to rely on what other people tell me. I'm just a reporter. But from what I understand, the stuff that's being sent, and if it's sent in sufficient enough quantities, particularly, you know, what the Poles can provide, what Slovakia can provide, some other countries, again, coming, you know, the former Warsaw Pact nations that have still have a pretty vast arsenal of Soviet-era equipment, it'll do some damage. And look, Ukraine still has the majority of its fixed wing and rotary wing air force in place, which is kind of remarkable. Now, the other thing too that they love, and they made a song about it, is the Bayraktar TB2 drone. And just today, in fact, Turkey's foreign minister is in Kyiv, again, encircled Kyiv, right? The Turkey's foreign minister managed to travel there. Why is he there, and what are they cooking up? No doubt that Turkey is going to supply more of these things. And so far, the Russians claim that they took out, you know, dozens of them. They've only provided evidence for one down TB2 drone. And Turkey was believed to have possessed 20 at the start of the war. My source in Ukrainian military intel, I'm sorry, Ukraine was believed to possess 20 of them at the start of the war. My source in GUR, their military intelligence service, I asked him, how many do you have? And he laughed and he said, let's just say it's enough. And they're getting more all the time. And these things can take out Pantsir air defense systems, tanks, columns of soldiers. I mean, I've seen the video footage of it. They're fierce. And the good thing about that is that Turkey has got a lot of battlefield experience with them because they deployed them to Libya, where they turned Russian military equipment, the aforesaid air defense systems and so on, into just gnarled hunks of metal. So there's proof of concept, which is another thing the Ukrainians love.
So yesterday, Vladimir Putin gave a speech, rambling, strange speech. My favorite tweet of the day was that it was sounded basically like a Steve Bannon podcast. you know, but he's threatening, you know, to cleanse the country of all of the, you know, the scum and the traitors, et cetera. I'm noticing that you're tweeting out this morning evidence of lots of flights out of Moscow in the wake of Vladimir Putin's speech. So cause effect, what's going on? Who's on those planes?
These flights are a bit weird. So they were coming from Moscow, headed to the Ural Mountains. there are two known deep, deep underground bunkers in the Urals. One, which is said to be kind of, you know, the Strangelovian doomsday bunker, where, you know, if Russia decided to launch its nukes, it would basically put its strategic command there, the president and all that. So a lot of, you know, sort of nervous chatter on Twitter. But then, strangely enough, these planes started to reverse and go back to Moscow. So the idea being maybe they're picking people up or dropping people off. I've also seen planes flying to Dubai, which would suggest some of the oligarchs are going to cool their heels in you know, the Emirates, where they, one of the few places they can still travel to because they're banned from the European Union. We don't really know. There's always a possibility that this is just more kind of kabuki theater to threaten the West. Because remember, you know, when Putin sort of made that call for nuclear alert, or I forget the exact term, there was no detected untoward activity on the ground among Russia's strategic defenses at the time. So it was just he gave the order to threaten us, to menace us into thinking he's ready to launch his nukes and start World War III. I mean, this is a game that the Russians play, and they play it well, and they're hoping that their rhetorical escalation will get us to de-escalate. And so far, to our credit, certainly to the Biden administration, but also to NATO and the European Union, we haven't really fallen for it, because there is no de-escalation on the West side. It's only escalation. Now, what kind of intrigues me, though, is where is Putin at the moment? It doesn't seem like he's in Moscow.
Really? Physically?
I've heard he's in one of these bunkers. And, you know, what's he doing there? And what that speech that you cited. So a lot of people read that and they say, this is it. This is the moment that he's become Stalin. He's gone from authoritarian to totalitarian. Yes, that's true. And I think that moment actually occurred last week when they started saying things like, if you engage in any anti-war activity, we'll conscript you and send you into the army, right? When they started arresting people holding up blank signs and, you know, all this thing. This is the creeping totalitarianization of Russia. However, I read that speech slightly differently. This is a man who is, remember, KGB case officer, albeit a mediocre one by all accounts, but a man who is steeped in counterintelligence and paranoia and worrying about what's coming from his own side. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the reason that the U.S. had such clarity on not only that there was going to be a war, but when it would start, I'm 85% certain, is because they have moles. They have people, assets in place inside the Russian government. Putin knows that he's running a leaky ship. He, depending on reports you believe, he's put 8 generals under house arrest already. He has also put under house arrest the head of the FSB's 5th service, Besieda, who this guy was basically running the Ukraine file. The FSB, even though it's the domestic security organ, has a foreign intelligence capability, believe it or not, one that was essentially created by Putin because he wanted the service that he directed to also kind of follow in the footsteps of the first chief directorate of the KGB, which is the former foreign service of the KGB. So putting Beseda and I think his deputy under house arrest, which was reported first by Andrei Soldatov, probably the best journalist in Russia, now living in the UK, who covers the security services, suggests that either this is punishment for them having sold him a bill of goods, telling him this is going to be a cakewalk when it's quite the other thing, or he is wondering how the Americans seem to know his every play before he plays it, right? So his paranoia, I think he's going to start cannibalizing. He already is. There was a report today, Bellingcat's Christo Grozev put out a comment on Twitter that, according to several of his sources, there have been more sackings and arrests of the deputy chief of basically Russia's National Guard, a guy who is very largely responsible because the Russian National Guard has been deployed to Ukraine. So if this is true, that he's been detained by the FSB, it shows that Putin is lashing out at his own kind, at his own people. He is deeply suspicious of how things like assassination plots, you know, that were cooked up for Zelensky are getting preempted. And if you listen to the Ukrainians, either they're being very clever with their psychological operations or they're telling the truth. They say, we have people from the FSB leaking us stuff because they're anti-war. They think this whole thing is just a catastrophic miscalculation and they don't want to see Ukraine go up in smoke. I mean, 11 million Russians have got some kind of familial or personal ties to Ukraine, many Russians in the Russian government and the security services are themselves ethnic Ukrainians. So he's got a big problem on his hands internally inside Russia.
Michael Weiss, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Well, we will have you back when we figure out how this all ends, because I'm very unclear what the end game is going to be here. Michael Weiss is the news director of the global affairs magazine New Lines, also the editor-at-large at The Daily Beast and director of special investigations at the Free Russia Foundation. Very much looking forward to your forthcoming book about the GRU, Russia's military intelligence agency. Thank you so much, Michael.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. We will do this all over again.